copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
All right, we're going to get going now here with my third theme, which is My Genes Made Me Do It, Biological Determinism. And ultimately, if you ascribe to a materialist worldview, you're atheist or agnostic, you're really left with one of two options, it seems to me. Either you're determined by your biology, your heredity, or by the environment. I'm going to talk about each of these, but right this talk I'm going to focus on biological determinism. So the notion that we're just what we are, our behavior is all shaped by our heredity. So that's why I call it My Genes Made Me Do It. Now, Viktor Frankl, who was a Jewish intellectual who survived the Holocaust and was in Auschwitz, astutely commented on the way that modern European thought had helped pave the way for the Nazi atrocities, which resulted in his own misery in Auschwitz. And here's what he said. He said, "If we present a man with a concept of man which is not true, we may well corrupt him. When we present man as an automaton of reflexes, as a mind machine, as a bundle of instincts, as a pawn of drives and reactions, as a mere product of instinct, heredity, and environment, we feed the nihilism to which modern man is, in any case, prone. I became acquainted," he said, "with the last stage of that corruption in my second concentration camp, Auschwitz. The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or, as the Nazis like to say, of blood and soil. I am absolutely convinced," Frankl said, "that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were ultimately prepared not in some ministry or other in Berlin, but rather at the desks and in the lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers." So that's a pretty sobering assessment of the trajectory of modern thought and how it's led to even to Auschwitz. And we've been talking here about the devaluing of human life, and certainly these philosophies that he's discussing, these nihilistic philosophies, have resulted in the devaluing of human life. And right now I want to examine just one of these kinds of ways of thinking, which is the biological determinism. Biological determinism was pretty prominent in the late 19th and early 20th centuries through the eugenics movement. I'm going to talk about that in just a little bit too, but it's become very popular again today in many respects. In the 1970s, a movement called sociobiology became very prominent in the biological disciplines. And then by the 1990s, we had evolutionary psychology, which became very prominent, which was arguing for biological determinism as well. And so I want to give just a couple contemporary examples before talking some about the historical development of these ideas of biological determinism. So here's one more popular example of how this plays itself out in, you know, popular discourse about My Genes Made Me Do It. So here's Time magazine from the United States in 1994. Robert Wright was sort of a popularizer of evolutionary psychology at the time, and he wrote this. The cover of Time magazine said, "Infidelity, it may be in our genes." And then the actual article's title was "Our Cheating Heart." And the article's basic position was that the reason that we commit adultery is because it's in our genes. You know, it's biologically programmed into us to be maritally unfaithful. And so this is just one kind of example of a way of trying to explain certain kinds of behavior based on evolutionary psychology. So it's hardwired into us, you know, by our genes. Another pretty very interesting example from the 1990s was Steven Pinker, who's a professor at Harvard University. And in 1997, he wrote an article called "Why They Killed Their Newborns." there had been a couple spectacular examples in the United States at that time of young women killing their newborn infants. One was a woman who had gone to her high school prom dance, and during the dance had given birth in the bathroom, and she threw her baby in the trash can and killed it, and it died. So. And there was other ones. So people were wringing their hands about this. And so Pinker comes along and writes this article, Why They Kill Their Newborns. And Pinker's explanation was that back in the Pleistocene era, he said, you know, back in ancient, ancient humanity, humans, he said, had to assess whether their infants had survival value, whether they thought their infants could survive. And so he actually says in this article that, these Pleistocene women would, when they gave birth to their babies, would coolly assess, you know, whether they had survival value and then determine whether they've killed them or not. And so he was claiming that infanticide was something that was programmed into them, and that the ones that would commit infanticide would survive and reproduce at higher rates, because then they would be able to nurture their other children better and keep them alive and survive and such. And this would then be hardwired into us. Now, of course, he didn't have any empirical evidence for any of this. This is just sheer hypothesizing and what many people refer to as just-so stories. And really, there's nothing. I mean, he never was able to interview any of these Pleistocene women to find out if they coolly assessed their newborn infants. And I rather doubt that. It seems to me he's kind of out of touch with reality in that respect. But in any case, this is a kind of explanation, okay? The genetic way of, your genes have made you to do these things. And so infanticide is in our genes too. There's a lot of evolutionary biologists and scientific materialists such as Richard Dawkins who are also promoting this kind of determinism. Dawkins, in one of his books, relates this comedy routine where a guy named Basil Fawlty, his car won't start. And so what does he do to his car? He goes out and he gets a branch off a branch and starts beating on his car because it won't start for him. You know, it's supposed to be funny because, of course, that's not going to help, right? You know, there's something wrong with the car. And Dawkins claims that a human being is also sort of like that car. And when people punish a human being for their bad behavior, they're being like Basil Fawlty, you know, beating this car. He says what you really need to do is try to figure out what's defective about the human being, and then try to deal with it. And here's what he actually says. He said, isn't the murderer or the rapist, this is Dawkins' words, isn't the murderer or the rapist just a machine with a defective component? So, you know, you murder someone, there's something defective about you. So we just need to try to repair that. You know, just like you'd repair a car. You don't punish someone, you know, for doing something like that. Just have a defective component. Interestingly, I think once again, you know, we're talking about the contradictions within worldviews. Dawkins really doesn't have any basis to claim it's defective if a person murders or rapes. What's defective about that? If it helps you to survive and reproduce, you know, then it's perfectly fine. And in fact, there's actually a book that came out a couple of decades ago called About Rape, that were an evolutionary psychologist, actually two of them, wrote a book in which they claimed that rape was programmed into us through evolutionary processes and such. And actually, Dawkins one time was pressed by a Christian about the issue of rape, and he had to admit that there's nothing objectively wrong with it, that he doesn't have any basis for objectively, he doesn't like it, and he thinks it's not a good idea, but on the other hand, he doesn't have any moral basis for critiquing it. So when he says a defective component, actually he's being not hewing true to his own views that everything's just biologically determined and doesn't have, there is no good or evil. Remember, I also quoted earlier one about where Dawkins said there's no good, there's no evil. You know, that's his view. So what's defective about it? In any case, what I want to do here is look at how we arrived at these biological determinist positions that I've just here given a few more contemporary examples of. Well, first of all, secularists, atheists, agnostics, and such see humans as being a cosmic accident. And so we're a product of mindless evolution. And so they believe then that human behavior is determined by either your biology, your heredity, or by your environment, by your upbringing. And so today we want to look specifically at the the biological side of that. And a lot of times when people are talking about evolutionary psychology, they're thinking about the evolution of altruism. There's a lot of psychologists and biologists who focus on how altruism has developed and cooperation and these kinds of things and what we might think of as positive moral traits. But they're also have to admit that other, what we would say, negative moral traits also have evolved over time, too. So warfare, deception, adultery, like I just showed you the example that I already gave there, infanticide, or abortion. Biological determinism began to be a significant influence intellectually in the Enlightenment period when materialism was first coming into prominence. Now, most Enlightenment thinkers, and this is in the 18th century, most Enlightenment thinkers were not materialists, but some were. There were a few, a minority of Enlightenment thinkers who did embrace materialism. There was a French physician named Julien Delametrie, and Delametrie was a staunch materialist and in 1747 wrote a book called Man the Machine. Man the Machine. So humans are just a machine. And so he thought that human behavior could be explained completely if you just understood the causes, you know, the biological and physiological causes that were feeding into that human being. And he specifically thought that it was mostly the product of heredity, so your biological makeup that's been passed on to you, and he also thought diet played a role, a key role. He had some interesting things to say about how he thought that eating different kinds of foods would lead to different kinds of behavior and inclinations and other kinds of things like that. Biological determinism was going to become a much stronger force in the course of the 19th century, especially by the late 19th century, as materialism and positivism were growing in their impact. And one of the key figures in this development was Charles Darwin's cousin, who's named Francis Galton. Francis Galton was considered the founder of the eugenics movement, and he was the one who coined the phrase in the mid to late 19th century of nature versus nurture. Okay, you've probably heard that phrase before. People talk about, you know, we're going to weigh the, you know, nature versus nurture. And so they debate that particular view. Well, first of all, by the way, I'd like to say about that, that's a false dichotomy. Okay, there's other possibilities like free will. So nature versus nurture is not really all the choices we have available. But to people with a naturalistic worldview, those are the only choices, essentially. It's nature or it's nurture. You know, one or the other have given rise to a human behavior. And Francis Galton believed that nature was preeminent and was paramount in developing human intelligence and human behavior. And so he thought that most human moral traits were biologically ingrained into us. In 1869, Galton wrote a book called Hereditary Genius, in which he argued that genius was a hereditary trait, and he looked at different families and showed that different musical families, you know, music would run in families, art would run in families, and he believed that that was a hereditary trait. He didn't think it was just because of upbringing and education and such. Galton ultimately founded the eugenics movement, which was trying to improve human heredity through selective breeding in various kinds of ways. And this was going to have a pretty profound impact throughout the Western world, in fact, even in Latin America and even parts of Asia and such. Here's an example showing you the eugenics mentality. This is from the United States, and this is a display that was put on in various county and state fairs by the American Eugenics Society, a society founded in the early 20th century to promote eugenics. And on the left side, it tells you that some people are born to be a burden on the rest, and then learn about heredity, and you can help correct these conditions. And it has these flashing lights, and I'm not going to go through each one of them there, but basically, certain lights would flash at certain intervals based on when people of different, what they saw as different levels of superiority or inferiority were reproducing. And so people who they defined as inferior, the ones over here, this light was flashing every 48 seconds, and this was supposed to signal people who are mentally incompetent. And over here, the light's flashing every 7.5 minutes, and that's supposed to represent people who are very intelligent and such. And so the idea here is that the wrong people are reproducing. Okay, and so the idea here is that the people are biologically determined by their traits, and we need to try to control human heredity to deal with this particular issue. So that's one example of how biological determinism was becoming very strong in the late 19th century. The other issue was scientific racism and the idea that races had differences not just in their skin color or not just in their shapes of their skulls and different things like that, but they also have differences morally between them. And in fact, Charles Darwin himself believed that and argued that different races had different moral characteristics. This comes from a Nazi periodical, the SS pamphlet, called Rassenpolitik from 1943. And the caption right here says, "Does the same soul, the same mind dwell in these different bodies?" And so the idea is that, okay, they're not just different physically, they're also different in the way they think. And if you read a lot of the literature there, you find also they think they're very different in their behaviors as well. And so that's all relating to their biology and heredity. So by the early 20th century, the eugenics movement and scientific racism were pretty powerful movements. They were actually dominating biology, anthropology, medical textbooks, long before the Nazis came on the scene. The Nazis were taking over ideas that were already mainstream in a lot of science. If you go back to even in the United States or Britain in the early 20th century, there's a lot of these ideas that are being bandied about. And again, this was being taught by professors, being taught in high school textbooks and such. So these are pretty common themes. And of course, Nazis were going to embrace a pretty radical vision of this notion of biological determinism. They were going to be some of the most radical proponents of biological determinism. But again, the ideas they were building upon had been there for a long time, and that's where they got those ideas, in fact. Hitler and the Nazis believed that some people were inferior or subhuman, was the term they used at times for them, not just physically or mentally, but even morally. And in fact, interestingly, the Nazis actually argued that the Jews, and Hitler in particular, argued that the Jews had bad moral characteristics, that the Jews were inherently biologically disposed toward evil and criminality. And here's a shot showing you a periodical from the from 1935 called Neues Volk, an article that was in there called The Criminal Jew. And so it has lists of here what different crimes these different Jews have committed. So it just tells you what the different crimes are there. And the notion, and if you read the article, the upshot of it is that the criminality is biologically ingrained in the Jews. And so this, by the way, meant that Hitler's desire to eliminate these people that he considers inferior, and particularly the Jews, Hitler actually thought he was going to improve things morally in the world by killing off the Jews, because the Jews are immoral, and the Germans, of course, he thought were moral. He thought they had all these good moral traits, right? They're truthful and brave and courageous and loyal and all these other things, whereas the Jews are deceitful and lascivious and greedy and all these negative traits. So you kill off the Jews, the world becomes better morally. So it's a really twisted kind of view of the biological determinism was going to impact those kind of debates. So here's a slide from the Nazi period, too, of what this was a school poster. These are posters showing the school children in the 1930s. And the top of it says, "Eradication of the sick and the weak in nature." That's what it says up here in this top caption. And then you see a raptor here that has killed a hare. And then you see a man who's getting ready to chop down this sickly-looking evergreen tree there. And this was supposed to be shown to biology classes in the context of discussing compulsory sterilization, which the Nazis had passed as a law in 1933, where you compulsorily sterilize people with various kinds of congenital illnesses, especially mental disabilities. What I find interesting here, though, is that you have death in both of these scenes here. This is not about sterilization. This is about killing. And it's sort of this propaganda was then going to prepare people for what was going to come later, which was the Nazis did kill people with disabilities. Over 200,000 people would die in the Nazi T4 so-called euthanasia program to kill people with disabilities. Now, after the Nazi period, and actually even during the Nazi period in the United States, biological determinism was going to take something of a dip. It was going to become less popular during the middle part of the 20th century. And environmental determinism was largely going to replace it in many fields. But it was going to make a comeback in the 1970s with E.O. Wilson and his sociobiology. This is the 2000 edition, the 25th anniversary edition of his book Sociobiology, but it originally came out in 1975, and it was called Sociobiology, the New Synthesis. And he argued very strongly for biological determinism, that many of our behaviors are determined by our biology. And coming on the heels of this, then a whole field of evolutionary psychology was going to emerge, certainly by the 1990s, and they were going to be looking at searching for genes for alcoholism, searching for genes for homosexuality. Some were even looking for genes for religion. You know, why people believe in religion. So let's find a gene. It must be a gene that, you know, makes people believe in religion. And such. There's this search for the gene has been a very prominent part of this notion of biological determinism. And today this idea of biological determinism is very popular among scientists and psychologists. Interestingly, it's not very popular, though, among social scientists who tend to embrace environmental determinism more often than not. Okay, let me now offer some critique of some of this idea. First of all, and let me say this too. First of all, as Christians, we do need to admit that biology has an influence on us. Okay, we're not denying that biology has any impact on human behavior. That's not what we're doing. But we do want to also recognize that there are other elements. Okay, biological determinism ignores environmental influences on human behavior. And in fact, I was at a seminar once where a evolutionary biologist was talking about the evolutionary ethics and such and the morally ingrained things. And he was talking about how different kinds of religions interacted with these kinds of behaviors. And he was talking about how he believed that the reason that Calvinism had triumphed in the 16th century was because of some of their particular religious beliefs, and that had helped them to triumph. But he really didn't have a clear understanding of the religious differences between these and how the environmental had shaped these things. And it was really kind of odd. And I noticed this in a lot of people arguing for biological determinism. So sometimes they will focus on some particular trait and look at it, and they'll claim that it's biologically ingrained. But then you look back a generation or two generations earlier, and I'm a historian, so I'm looking here historically at things, and you say, well, you know, two generations ago, people didn't do that as much as they do today. So how can you say now that that's biologically determined, but two generations ago, it wasn't what people were doing? And evolutionists don't think you can change that much in two generations, you know, so it can't be a product of evolution taking place. So they ignore some of these historical changes that have taken place. So especially thinking about sexual morality and sexual behaviors, which sometimes they will then talk about, which have changed radically over the course of the 20th century. So if adultery is in our genes, like Robert Wright said, and I showed you earlier on here, then, you know, how is it that, you know, it hasn't been as, it's been, obviously it's existed for forever. I'm not arguing that it hasn't existed earlier, but how does it change historically? Why is it that sometimes there's more of it than at other times historically? And also, the notion of biological determinism also reduces human agency. And that's another key point, I think. It denies free will. And we as Christians tend to, at least most that I know of, believe that humans have element of free will to be able to make choices. That's part of what makes us in the image of God. And so by denying free will, they're devaluing who we are as humans. And finally, biological determinism relativizes morality because it assumes that moral traits are simply a part of the evolutionary, have been produced by chance processes in the evolutionary history, and this eliminates any objectivity for human rights. So I would argue that biological determinism, even though, again, it may have some element to truth to it, that is that there are ways that biology does influence our behavior, nevertheless is overshooting the mark, and by doing that, it ends up devaluing human life.